All right. Welcome to the Train Smart Podcast with Velox Training Group. I'm Nick Young, the lead instructor and host of Velox Training Group and this podcast. We've got Max Gates. He is my AI. We travel all over the country teaching practical shooting stuff, basically teaching people how to go fast and be more accurate. Today, we have a super special guest. If you've seen him on Instagram, YouTube, you've probably seen him doing some pretty sporty shooting and possibly yeeting a rifle or a shotgun into a trash can. Joe Farewell, thanks for coming on, buddy.
Hey, Nick, great to have you. Thanks for having me. Great to have you here in my office, and I'm glad to be in your office too. Thanks for having me on the podcast, man.
Yeah, man, anytime. I've been actually wanting to have you for quite a while. So we've got a bunch of different questions, and a bunch of them were pretty similar, but I think starting off, you know, this is stuff that people get really, really jazzed up about. It's about gear, but, you know, how do you set up your rifle specifically? And maybe it's for shooting a match, maybe do you have a training rifle, et cetera. So let's hear some of your thoughts on rifle setup. That'd be a good place to start, I think.
Sure. So I have two primary rifle setups that I run. And the first one, which is probably the one that I shoot the most, would be this one. It's an 11.5 Cobalt Kinetics. Mm-hmm. And it is bone stock. I run this thing just as stock as can be. I throw a red dot on top. We're running the Vortex Spark Solar. I beat the hell out of this dot optic. I think I've had it on here for probably 4 or 5 years now.
Oh, wow.
Three or four years. Like I've put it through its paces. I run in the Cobalt Kinetics can, and that's it. It's got Geissele two stage. That's what comes on it. And then this is my favorite sling that I found, the Faro Concepts. I don't know if you play with those at all. I don't have any affiliation with them, but it's a great freaking sling. And I just replaced the barrel in this rifle because it was tumbling real bad. And for those of you who haven't replaced the barrel before, that is kind of like I view that as a rite of passage for most people. That like, hey, you've actually shot the rifle to the point where you can have some conversation in this game.
Mm-hmm. I'm a fan, man. This 11.5 that's right here. I replaced the barrel after about a year and a half in this thing.
Yeah, I've gone through two uppers. I went from a 10.5 on this or 10.3 on this to the 11.5, and then replaced the barrel on this one once. And I have two 13.7s that need to be replaced. And I just replaced this 14.5 last year. So this is my competition setup. This one's got a lot more details to it. Obviously, it's more customized because of the race that we run. So this one is my three-gun setup. I have a very similar rifle for IPSC. Shot World Shoot in 2019 and in 2024, so last year. And I found that for World Shoot, for that type of shooting, where we're getting really precise hits, we're trying to get alphas out at 60, 70, 80 yards offhand. The most soft recoil impulse possible and the highest velocity possible is good. So I run an 18-inch. This is a 14.5. I prefer a shorter rifle. It's my preference. I like a shorter, lighter, more maneuverable rifle. But that 18-inch worked really well for Rifle Worlds. This rifle is, like I said, a 14.5. I'm running a 1.7 Badger Ordnance mount with their offset. Got the 1-10 on top. The 1-6 Vortex 1-6 is my favorite optic for most things. However, anytime that I'm running matches that are going to have a lot of shooting out past 350 or 400 yards, I go to the 1-10. There is definitely an advantage to that over the 1-6. Yeah.
People are going to ask why 1.7 height? Why not a 1.93? Why not a 2.2? Why not a 1.54? Why 1.7?
It's a great question. It's all about consistency and cheek weld. Okay. I like the 1.54 a lot. The 1.7 gives me a little bit higher mount, okay, as far as my cheek weld goes, but I'm still getting a really good cheek weld. What I found is if we go to a 1.9, to a 2.2, to a 2.73, whatever the hell those things are, like, I want to have my cheek on the gun. If I'm sitting here with my cheek completely off the gun, then I'm not going to be able to get as consistent and it's not as fast. The three things that I look at for any piece of gear, and I'm talking about a muzzle device, a trigger, you know, a scope mount, any of those pieces of gear, is it going to make me more or less accurate? Is it going to make me faster or slower? And can I do it consistent? And if any of those things degrade those three standards, then I start throwing things in the trash. And that applies for gear and it applies for technique. So anytime somebody pitches a technique, and I tell this to all of my students, I tell this across the board, anyone pitches you a technique and is like, hey, do this. And I'm like, well, that's not consistent. Like I can, a scoop draw, great example, scoop draw. I can scoop draw pretty consistently. Okay, I can do my snatch draw out of the holster with about 100% consistency, 99.9% consistency. A scoop draw is about 0.15 to 0.2 seconds faster. However, I can get that at about 80% consistency. So is the trade-off for consistency and speed worth the squeeze? For me, most of the time it's not, especially bouncing from a more of an USPSA style holster to a duty holster where we're using a thumb release, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, it's not worth it to practice the scoop draw unless we're doing some sort of an Instagram challenge where I'm like, I need that 0.6 draw. Otherwise, I'm going to stick with my technique that I can hit consistently, but I apply that to gear as well. So with a 193 or a 2.1 or a 2.2, whatever the hell they are, I'm not going to get a consistent cheek weld. And then you also get into height over bore, which, mechanical offset and your zero and all that stuff. That's just knowledge, platform knowledge.
Yep.
And if you know it, you can be consistent with that. I'm not too worried about that. As long as you practice it, you know it. But that's the main reason. The 1.7, I play with for a few years now. I like it, but I would go back to a 1.54 with no problem.
Yep. I'm with you on the cheek weld thing. I think, like, for me, the way I try to conceptualize at least that part of the connection, it's like when I lift the shoulder up and bring the stock up to my cheek, I'm essentially jamming the stock into my cheek and it's trapping it in two different places.
Yep.
So like if I had a super high mount and I can't put my cheek on there, it's like you're just giving up that one point of connection.
Right. It's a point of connection. It's a point of consistency. And at the end of the day, it's degrading your ability to shoot. And this is something that I recently put out a video about, like, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. Just because you can get away with it doesn't mean that there's not something better to do. So, yes, I shoot like this. Can I shoot decent like this with my head completely off the rifle? Yes, but could I shoot better if I had my cheek on the rifle? Also, yes. So why not go for the better technique? That's what I always push for. And when we do performance-based technique, then your feelings don't matter. I really don't give a shit about how you feel about it.
Yeah. Now, when you say, can you shoot like this and be fast and accurate? Now, people are going to say, like, oh, man, I can, like, on my GBRS mount, sorry. I don't need a good cheek weld, and I could still hit alphas. Yeah. Is that true? For sure. Sure.
Of course you probably can.
However, how are you, and I think this is where, like, I fully agree with you, and I think this is where people like us kind of separate from the guys who are like, hey, I could totally do that same exact thing with a GBRS mount. Like, how are you validating that stuff in your training? Is it hits on target? Is it the time? Is it?
It's both. It has to be both. Because when we look at practical shooting, it's two goals, right? Get the hits on target and do it as quickly as possible. And if there's anything that degrades from that, then you're hurting yourself. So can I shoot a Goober's mount like that? Can I shoot a mount that's 17 inches high? Absolutely, I can. Can I get accurate with it? Yes, I can. Can I get fast with it? Yes, I can. However, and this is where the big asterisk comes in, can I do all of those things faster, more accurately, and more consistently with a lower mount? Also, yes. So I would want to go with the better of the two. There are some caveats there, and that is mission specific. Those are mission specific situations where you're doing a lot of gas mask work. Now, mind you, I was on the SWAT team. I used a regular 1.54 mount on my red dot, and I qualified with perfect scores every time with a gas mask. It is doable. Night vision. I've also run that with night vision. It is not easy. And yes, a big offset or big mount will help you with those things. And if those are your reasons behind why you're running a big, tall mount, fine. A lot of the teams that I work with currently, their main concern now is the peer-v-peer combat. So instead of like dealing with, Afghanis running, 40, 50-year-old AKs and nothing else, riding a donkey. Now we're dealing with, or potentially dealing with, top tier operators on the opposite, you know, on the opposing force. And so using a passive aiming like a laser or something like that is not going to be as effective because they also have the same capabilities we have. So they need to use active aiming as an optic. So there are some conversations to be had there. I don't dive into that too much. Like if you have a good reason to run that, and that is you understand that there are drawbacks to it, then that's fine. Run what you want to run. Just train well enough.
That's the ticket for me. As long as you're realistic about I'm making these sacrifices and understand I'm sacrificing something, but you can articulate why that's important or why that's necessary, then, you know, fine. I'm not in any position to argue that, but you have to be realistic about what the sacrifices are you're making.
100%. I think too, like when you talk about this subject, people get wrapped up, and I made a YouTube video about it, and then I was kind of surprised, but I shouldn't have been surprised. But like, there's people on there that are like, why do you care what I run? I'm like, I actually don't.
Yeah, right?
I really don't.
Zero. Yeah.
I don't care, right? However, I made that video for people that are possibly looking for more information. Like, hey, what optic height should I run? And to me, it's like, you hit the nail on the head. Consistency has to be there.
You know what's funny? So I did a training day with Kyle Litzy and AJ Anthony, two of the other guys who were on the US team for the World Shoot. And we had a day on the range and got to shoot a whole bunch together and feed off of each other. And you know, it was really good. Like training with guys that are at that caliber. You know, we were hoping to have Daniel Horner out there too, so the four of us on the team could train together. That didn't pan out. But it was funny because all of our rifles were set up almost identical with the difference in optic height. So I was running 1.7. AJ and Kyle were running 1.5s, 1.54s. But AJ has a cheek riser that's like this high, and it's just because of his bone structure. Like his face is different. I could smash my face all the way down on the rifle. I still could not look through his optic. Like I crushed my face into the rifle, could not see through his optic. Okay, I pushed my face hard on Kyle's rifle, and I could run his rifle, and I actually almost had to run his rifle the first couple of days of the match because my guns got stuck in Dallas of all places. But like I was comfortable, I could use his rifle if I needed to. But both of those guys were running lower mounts because that cheek weld makes a difference. And if you want to look at what setups work well, look at what the top shooters in the world are doing. And I'm not talking about like, hey, I'm on, you know, DevGru, or I'm on like whatever tier one operation you want to be. Those guys have some valid points, but look at the ones who are competing at the top. I think the competition is a true test of gear. And I think that it does highlight what works and what doesn't work. And yeah, top competitors try different gear, and it's always evolving. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to run something that's going to hold me back. If I can get a 3% edge off of somebody else by switching to something, I will. I'll do it.
Yep. 1,000%. 1,000%. What do you, I'll ask you this because I already know the answer and I think people would find it interesting. What do you zero that gun at? Your competition rifle.
The competition rifle, I actually zero depending on the optic and the ammo and the rifle. So I zero this. This rifle is currently zeroed at 235 yards. Because what that allows me to do is have my holds line up properly in my optic. So the difference between a 200-yard zero and a 235-yard zero is very minimal until you get out to 400 and 500 yards. All right, so like this past weekend, I shot the Florida State Multigun Championship, and we had targets on one stage all the way up to 600 yards.
You won the championship.
Yes, yeah. I won the championship.
Don't be modest, sir.
I won the championship by a healthy margin.
Okay, there you go.
But on that one stage, we had targets out to 600 yards. And because of, and there's different arguments for this, and I'll you know, start off by saying it doesn't matter what your zero is as long as you know your holds inside and out and you know them really well and you can get to them quickly. What does help though is having your holds line up in your reticle. So I use an app called Chairgun Elite Plus, and it's very effective. I have a whole video breaking down exactly how I get my zeros, how I develop a zero, showing you the process of developing, confirming, and working a zero. That's all in my Dry Fire Crew community. But I picked that zero because my, even though my hold, my dead hold is 235, my first line is 300, my second line is 350, my third line is 400, my fourth line is 450, my fifth line is 500. Like, it is literally 3, 4, 5, 6 right down the reticle.
It's a BDC reticle, or is it mils or MOA?
This one is the Vortex 1 to 10 BDC.
Okay.
Now, for Rifle World Shoot, because it's an 18-inch rifle, my ballistics are different. Running a 75-grain bullet, I end up switching scopes. I was going to run the 1 to 6 MOA, and I end up switching both of my rifles over to the MRAD because the MRAD lined up better for the ballistics on those rifles. I actually ended up going with a 100-yard zero, and then on that, with that 100-yard zero, I was able to have the first line at 300, the second line at 400, the third line at 500, and that's, to me, what makes you fast on a stage, all right, because it takes out a whole lot of thinking.
Yeah.
Now, there are a dozen different ways to set up a rifle and a zero, and you got to figure out what works for you, but the best way that I found for what I do in the three-gun world and working with a lot of guys doing DMR stuff, LPVO stuff, knowing that your second line is 300 yards and your third line is 400 yards, if you have any targets in the intermediate space between those, it's really easy to do. You just bracket them. Now, saying yep. that if your second line is 370 yards and your third line is 420 yards, now we've got this whole issue of like, okay, well, he's at 320, so I need to put... It makes you think too much, and thinking takes time.
Yep, I agree. No, I love that. I actually have a LPVO setup where I've got a K16i and I think it's the SM1 reticle is what they call it, but it's basically like a circle dot, basically just like an EOTech, but it's a MRAD reticle. At the bottom of the circle is 400 yards. Anywhere inside of that yardage, I'm just basically holding high on the freaking top of the steel. And I've proven that to be like really, really good on 6-inch steel all the way out to 400. But I think what I'm hearing here is like experiential learning. Like, you actually have to go out and test this stuff, maybe chronograph your gun. Like, it's actually super important. It's like mega nerd stuff, but man, you can't just go like, hey, I watched this video. You know, it was titled How to Zero by a Navy SEAL or something like, and then like just go rock with it with your setup. It's like, man, that might not be the key for you. And I see it a lot. I see it with like Unity mounts. People have Unity mounts. I still have some Unity mounts too. It's like, I'm either way. I really don't care. But like those Unity mounts with a 36-yard zero do some crazy stuff at distance with different people's setups. So I don't know. I typically tell people like with the higher mounts, you might want a little bit further zero just to make it a little bit flatter trajectory and stuff. But all of this is things that you don't find out if you don't go out and actually test this stuff.
Yes.
At distance.
And none of it's hard. It's just not the sexy stuff. I mean,
it's not fun. It's the homework side of things that nobody likes to do. It's dry and boring. Yeah. But it will teach you, if you spend half a day on the range just actually learning about your zero and testing things out, even just like 400 yards, what is your spin drift? Have you ever tested? Like, you know, if you're round, you might be perfectly 0 to 200, but then you go out to 400 and you put your perfect hole on there and suddenly it's 6 inches off to the right because you have a right-hand twist and it's spinning that bullet over. It makes a difference. 400, not as much, but you get out 500, 600, it actually pushes that round off quite a bit. And that's with no wind. Like, then you start learning wind. Like, this, it's a whole deep rabbit hole that you can go down.
Yep. I remember like way back when I shot like PRS type stuff at 1,000 with my 6.5 Creedmoor, I would always hold half a mil to the left on the plate. And it's because of that exact reason that you just said.
Yep. It makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Massive difference. Dude, I dig it. I dig it. Which of those rifles do you train with the most?
It depends on what I'm doing. So if I'm getting ready for a big match, I'm definitely training on the three gun. And I have another three gun rifle that's set up almost identical to this that I'll actually use my training rifle. This is my match rifle because the barrel's good and I want to keep it as good as long as possible. So I'll run this one in training for like the last couple days before a match, the last training session or two before a match to verify my holds, make sure everything feels right. And then the rest of the time I'm running a copycat rifle that is very similar, but I can burn out that barrel and not have to worry about it. That being said, most of the time I actually definitely put a lot more rounds to this rifle for a couple of reasons. One, when I'm teaching, this is the one I'm using for any law enforcement military classes. And that's my primary class type right now. Is Ellie and Mill, and this is what I'm running, either suppressed or unsuppressed, depending on what we're doing. And so I have a lot more rounds through this rifle, and I train with it a whole lot more. So when I teach a class, typically, after the class, I'll spend some time, and depending on where I'm at, I may have a couple hours that I can sit there and shoot, and that's usually what I'm running there.
Now, how come you don't teach law enforcement or Mill with the other gun?
Same reason I don't teach law enforcement or Mill with a $6,000 Atlas. There, for a couple of reasons. Now, at the end of the day, if you have good structure with either rifle, it's going to be the same results. Mm-hmm. Okay, if I have the same grip, same trigger press for an Atlas as I do with a SIG or a PDP or a Glock, it doesn't matter. Okay, it's a big portion of it is the shooter. However, if I walk up to a law enforcement class where everyone's running PDPs and I step up with an Atlas and everyone kind of looks over and like, okay, this guy's running an Atlas. There is a degree, there's a new challenge to overcome before I can connect with those guys.
Yeah, 1,000%.
And so I try to avoid that. And this is for instructors out there. This is something that you can do to kind of help yourself. Now, the second day I'll break out the Atlas. Even after afternoon, the first day, I might break it out, let them shoot it. Okay. I'll demo stuff with their guns, but that, especially that initial contact, those first impressions make a big difference. If I break out a full race setup, a compensated rifle and light bolt carrier and all this stuff, you got to know your crowd. Mm-hmm. And if they're running a freaking Colt M4 with a Daniel Defense upper that's shot the hell out with a tri-prong, and then I break out this thing that has zero recoil, and it's obvious it has zero recoil.
I know. I shot that thing. It was amazing.
It's ridiculous.
It was really amazing. Weird. Yeah.
And there's an advantage to that, obviously. So if I go up and do a demo, that demo goes in one ear and out the other because it doesn't matter because I'm not using the same stuff. So yeah. For me, I when I'm teaching those types of groups, because mind you, they're professionals. And you have to treat them like professionals. These are not like base level shooters. Now, shooting skill wise, there's oftentimes a disparity there between a professional and a base level shooter. However, you have to treat them like professionals because that's what they are. At the end of the day, they are a professional with a gun. They carry it. They get paid to carry a gun. And so you have to treat them as such. If you walk up there and burn down a demo with some race gun, it's immediately, you're going to take a hit on your credibility, in my opinion. Now, other people have argued with me on that. I'm like, I've seen it happen. I've seen it personally happen.
Yep.
And when you walk up there like, no, I'm just shooting a stock SIG. Just like, you're shooting a stock Glock, I'm shooting a stock SIG. There's nothing different about it. Okay, cool. Well, yep. Now you just showed that you can do this up here with the same gear that they're doing. And yep. Then if I take, and actually the best demo that I do is when I can grab somebody else's gun, show them what they're doing with it, and then show them how to correct it and show them what it looks like. And they're like, holy shit, it actually works with my gear. There's no disparity between the two. It's just technique. Mm-hmm. As an instructor, that's where I found the biggest breakthroughs. But there is a definite barrier to overcome when we have those, a fancy gun, ported, $7,000 pistol that you step up with, and they're like, oh God, here we go. Just another competition shooter trying to show off, right? It's like, no, not really.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I never want my crowd to believe that my skills are attached to a specific piece of gear that I have. And honestly, only instructors have to deal with that, right?
Yeah.
And I think the challenging thing about that is, like, I'm sure you would just much rather just shoot your freaking three-gun rifle.
Oh,
it's easier to shoot. Like, that's the one that you're going to go compete with. However, you got to put in work with, like, what I've got here, like an 11.5-inch with a three-prong on it. Like, this thing is pretty damn violent.
Yep.
But, like, I'm going to go put in work with that and make sure that I can do the exact same stuff with that thing than I can with, you know, a rifle that I would have with a dual-port break on it.
100%. Absolutely. It makes a big difference in the way that you're perceived. And perception, as we all know, perception, you know, to some degree is truth. Yep. It may not be the actual truth, but if that's what somebody perceives of you, then nothing that's true actually matters.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure the perception matches the truth. So if you can go and execute with a three-gun rifle, and then you can go and execute with a, you know, tri-prong 11.5, then you're good. Yep. And if you can go execute with a tri-prong 11.5, then a three-gun rifle is going to be easy mode. And it is. I will tell you, one of my challenges bouncing between the two is over-controlling my three-gun rifle coming off of a long stint with a work rifle.
I can totally see that.
Like, driving into it, I'm like, no, I just didn't let this thing shoot.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think, like, the most challenging thing about the three-gun rifle is, like, hey, just don't freaking move this thing.
Yeah, let it do its thing.
Yeah. I think one cool thing that has definitely helped, too, with, you know, exploring rifles that, you know, shoot a little bit harder than, for instance, like your three-gun rifle there, is, like, I've actually figured out, like, hey, as an instructor, like, hey, this is probably what this group of people are feeling with their own rifle, with their duty gun, you know? And it's helped me figure out, you know, ways to teach it a little bit better. So I think, you know, as an instructor, it's definitely helped.
100%.
Sure.
Most definitely. And I've shot matches with this rifle just to show that I can, and I enjoy it. I actually enjoy playing with other guns in matches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is a good segue into talking about how you mount the gun.
Sure.
So let's go into all the little nuances of it, and this should be good because I think it'll help people out.
So there's definitely a couple different ways that people mount the guns out there. I've seen some different ways that people preach it. You and I have a slightly different methodology when it comes to mounting the rifle. Mine, I've played with this stuff hard for probably the last 7 or 8 years now. Mm-hmm. Before Rifle World Shoot in 2019, I was decent with rifle. I was pretty good. I was shooting a lot of three gun at the time, and it was probably late 2018, early 2019 when I was getting ready to shoot Rifle World Shoot. I'm like, I'm going to deep dive. And I did. I deep dove into rifle super hard, put a ton of time into dry fire and live fire with it. And, you know, every time we have a hyper-focused situation like that, I learn. And even this last go-around, I learned even more. And what I found is the structure behind the rifle is everything. And so one of the things that I do to teach rifle, and it depends on, you know, I don't know if the guys watching this or listening to this later on, you're not going to be able to see what I'm talking about unless you're watching the video. But one of the big things is how we create a surface on our shoulder. So if you look at the surface of your shoulder as a wall, if I have my shoulder rolled back, I usually use a magazine to demo this. I'll put a mag on my shoulder like this and roll the shoulder back. And wherever that surface is, where that rifle is going to drive. So what I want to do is create a flat surface for that rifle to sit against. And that's going to create 99% of our recoil management through the surface of our shoulder. Rolling that shoulder forward creates engagement. I call it in battery or out of battery. Because if we roll the shoulder back as out of battery, you're going to see a lot looser stock position. And then the biggest thing for me is making sure that our shoulder that we're shooting off of is squared to the target. And then our hips should be squared to the target as well. What I found is if we blade our hips in any direction, we're going to start moving in that direction. So one thing that I will have people do, especially if we have an issue with a lot of blading, where they do a wide blade, for the guys that can see this, I'll kind of demo this real quick. If my target is here and I start to blade my body like this, off to the right-hand side, you're going to see rounds start lifting to the right. Even if I start driving into this, like if I really roll in, I have my chest now squared to the target, even though my hips are bladed, that helps. But one thing I started having people do a lot of times in classes is switch feet. So the traditional right foot back, left foot forward rifle structure is what we see across the board. If you switch feet, put right foot forward, left foot back, it's going to force that right shoulder into a position where it's going to be engaged. And what I've seen with a lot of people, not just competitors, but also on the law enforcement military side, is as soon as they do that, they're like, holy shit, like the rifle doesn't move now. I'm like, there's a reason for that, because now your shoulder's engaged and it can't not be engaged because your right foot's forward. And when they do that, once they've captured that, it doesn't matter where your foot placement is. Okay, because the structure behind the rifle has to do with making sure your hips are back and your back is at a forward angle. Because if we go back straight up and down, it's going to rock you back. I don't care what you say. I will defend that to the death, because I can put it on slow motion and show you. As soon as you drop the hips back and you put your back at a forward angle, that is where we see structural control over the rifle that you don't get otherwise. So when we see these guys doing straight up and down CQB,
leaning back,
lean back is even worse. Especially, you know, we see that all the time when they go to pie a door and or work a corner or whatever, it's immediately leaning back. And I can't stand that, because that is putting you into a poor shooting structure. And the moment that you're most likely going to need it is right there in that threshold, or as you come around a corner. So what I encourage guys, like, you don't have to be in this, you know, super aggressive, like athletic posture all the time. But if you're going to be getting into a gunfight, that's where you want to be. So if you're walking around, fine. But as soon as you start shooting, that's where you need to drop into a proper structure. When we put that right foot forward and force the hips in the position, force the shoulder in position, and then we can go back into a regular, you know, left foot forward, or even, I don't like feet in alignment. You should never, ideally, never have your feet perfectly in alignment to the target, because then you're kind of standing on that nice blade where you're going to rock backwards.
Yep.
However, you can if you have to, but as long as you're rolled into it and you have the proper structure behind the gun, it'll still work.
Cool.
That was one of the leaning into it. That was actually where, that was when I decided to go back from a 1.96 or whatever the tall optic height was. Cause I'm, you know, I'm 6'3", and I thought heads up shooting, that sounds good. But heads up shooting just means I'm not leaning forward.
Yep.
Gonna hurt some feelings.
No, but that's a great example of learning through experience, right? That heads up shooting is great because it does allow you to stand up straight and be comfortable. However, it takes away from your ability to shoot. When you lean down into it, so if I have a really high mount on this rifle and I lean forward like I should be, and now I have to have my head up, it is awkward as hell.
Yes.
I'm putting tension into my neck that shouldn't be there. When I have a lower mount and I lean into it, then I'm just basically resting my head on my rifle and there's not a whole lot of extra tension. Less tension is good, but standing up into a bad posture to achieve that less tension is not good.
Right.
So there's this balance of how do we make this work? And performance is the only way that we can track that. And how do we track performance, accuracy on target, and the speed at which you get it? That's the only things that I care about. And then the consistency.
That's where principles trump gear, right? Gear should enhance the principles as opposed to draw away from them. And that was a clear one to me. I mean, that shooting posture for rifle, I didn't give it enough credit, because I felt like it's rifle. It doesn't recoil that much, you know. Come on.
Dude, I show people it with pistol.
Yeah.
Like, people stand straight up with a pistol, and it's like you could watch their nose. Like, at the front of my finger is their nose. You could watch their nose, like, move back, and it's like, dude, if you would just take your upper back and round out just the very top of your upper back. Like, if a good example of this, like, if you watch Christian Seiler shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Great example of that. Like, upper back rounded out.
He's not a bad shooter.
Yeah, I would say he's decent, right?
You don't know who Christian Seiler is, he's multi-time world champion, multi-time national champion. So he's pretty not bad.
Christian does very hard intercourse with a pistol.
Yes.
And from the looks of things, does very hard intercourse with the rifle as well.
It does.
Where do you put the stock in your shoulder?
So you have that old thing of like find the pocket. I've found that the pocket, quote unquote pocket, doesn't really exist as a pocket. It's more of like finding the right spot where it can integrate into your body as best as possible. We don't want to get this thing too far out on our shoulder. I also don't like saying like put it in the middle of your chest. There is a spot for me, and truly everybody's a little bit different here, depending on your the gear that you're wearing, your physical fitness, your physical build. You know, if you have a huge chest where you're just absolutely ripped,
so me,
like Nick, yeah, over here,
I deal with, yeah.
Yeah, it's not okay. You may have a slightly different position. I do want it fairly close to my center line. The farther out from our center line we get, the more rotational force is going to put on your body. But there's not a specific spot. Now, the important thing is the top of the rifle, so the top of the buttstock or the buffer tube here, is not going to be above my shoulder. I want that tucked down into my shoulder, not above it. And usually when I create, even if I have this, like, again, if you guys are watching the video, you'll see, but if I have the toe of the stock in my shoulder here, like we see a lot of times, and then I just create that forward lean, I'm not actually changing the position of the toe of the stock. It's still in the same spot, but suddenly it goes from up above my shoulder because I'm standing upright to tucked down into my shoulder because I just rolled into it. So I want to see the top of that buffer tube inside your body, not above it. One thing that I use this as an example, I'm not super scientific about it, but it makes sense to me. The path of recoil travels down your buffer tube. And so if you put all the support on the toe of the stock, that path of recoil now has leverage over you. Okay. If I put all the support here, now that path of recoil is punching into my body versus leverage over my body. So that's what I'm looking for with that, is I want to have the entire buttstock have surface behind it versus just half of the buttstock, especially the bottom half of the buttstock. If I had to choose, it would be the top half.
So would you say, like, so maybe not the very pocket of your shoulder, like in between your pec muscle and your shoulder muscle, maybe like just barely on the inside of your pec muscle is where you place the stock?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
And it's funny because, you know, it's hard to see this stuff with, if you're not watching the video, if you guys are listening to this, it's hard to tell without really playing with it. And this is where having a hands-on class comes in, you know, huge, because, you know, Nick or I can sit there and actually manipulate your body until we get you in the position where you feel it. Oh, that's cool. I just did like freaking fireworks behind me. That's awesome.
I don't know why I did that.
I think two thumbs up gives you fireworks. Yeah,
look at that. Oh, there it goes.
That's, all right. That's amazing. Happy New Year.
Not for you,
Nick. Do that with mine.
No fireworks for Nick.
That's weird.
But being able to manipulate your body into the right position makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And the other thing too is, like, I have a carbine course online on the Dry Fire Mastery site. Like, getting into each aspect of this and breaking piece by piece down makes a big difference versus like going out in the range and trying to run a bunch of drills and also figure out, is my structure right? Don't do that. Like, yeah. You need to isolate and correct before you start doing macro drills. That's why we do micro versus macros. It's the way my brain works.
I agree. What do you think about in terms of pressures on your mount? Like, are you trying to keep consistent pressures? Are you trying to just more or less float the gun there and not put any pressure on the gun? Are you pulling more with one hand or the other? What do you try to think?
It's definitely not a hard pull, and it's definitely not a float. Okay, I just want a consistent pressure against my shoulder to keep it in place. My shoulder and how I roll it forward and backwards is what's going to control the recoil. My left hand is all about aiming and how to get the rifle to where I want it to go and keeping it against my shoulder. Okay, I don't want to loosen it up to where it's bouncing, but I also don't want to be applying a lot of pressure, because if I'm using my left hand to pull into my shoulder, it's a whole lot harder to aim with finesse, and that's what the whole left hand's job is. Okay, so by using that extra tension pulling in, it degrades my ability to move effectively the muzzle of the rifle. So I want to have consistent pressure there to where it's controlling, then my shoulder controls the recoil, but this hand is not going to add a whole bunch of tension to it. I've seen where you talk about like dropping the elbow. I've also done that. I don't like to like pull it in here. I kind of have it at a neutral position here. Not high, definitely not high, because then we're putting tension on our shoulder. Anywhere that we're putting extra tension is not necessarily a good thing. I want to have this here and then kind of like let it pull into my shoulder, not down, same. Not high.
Yeah, same.
So I think it's interesting. You don't hear enough people talk about how pressures on your, you know, left hand, your support hand. Everybody talks about how it impacts recoil, but this is the first time I've heard somebody talk about how it impacts aiming. And I think that's an interesting little, because I mean, it intuitively makes sense, right? You've got a lot more muscles involved. It's going to be hard to make fine adjustments. I found in my experience, the reason I started to get away from it, when I was trying to rip the shit out of the gun, I was then letting up to get, you know, a good transition, a wide transition. I was letting up to push the gun over and then hauling back on it again. So it was super inconsistent. I was changing pressures back and forth every time. Who knows if I got the same pressure? So yeah, it is obviously it impacts recoil, but that's an interesting kind of point about it. It really is your left hand is there to help you move the gun around as much as it is to hold it into your shoulder, and you can't do that if you're cranking on it.
Yep, and so in my first 5 minutes of a rifle class, I talk about what each position. We have 4 points of contact. What each point of contact is for. Okay, right hand works the buttons. Right, we work the buttons: trigger, safety, mag release. I'm not yanking in with my right hand. Left hand aims and keeps the gun in contact with my shoulder. Shoulder controls the recoil. That's the entire job of the shoulder and my structure. Cheek needs to be consistent so I can maintain sight picture every single time I mount the gun. Those are 4 points of contact. Each one of them has a purpose. So if we start trying to control the recoil with our left hand or our support hand, then we're taking away from the left hand's ability to aim correctly. And you're not going to let the shoulder do its job properly either. Right. There can only be one chef in the kitchen. If you have too many chefs in the kitchen, then we screw things up. And so that's what I found is as soon as I start trying to control recoil with my left hand, I start pulling rounds off to the left hand side of the target every time.
Yep.
That's really well.
So that left hand has 1,000%. To be, keep it in contact with the shoulder and aim the freaking gun.
Yep. 1,000%. Dude, so someone asked, we have a bunch of questions here because Joe asked, you know, hey, what should we talk about on the podcast? But someone asked what the differences are between my mount and your mount, like basically the way we conceptualize it. I'll be honest, man, just listening to you talk about it, there ain't a whole lot of differences there. Aside from, I try not to be completely square to the target. I find that if I do that with, you know, a gun that is super soft, I love it. Like, it looks really, really good. The dot just basically jiggles around. But the second that I try it with more of like a duty style rifle, it feels like it almost creates a hinge point for me where like the gun really, really lifts. And so I find that blading, not now I say bladed and people think automatically like completely sideways to the target. Like, no. The shoulder just wouldn't be all the way forward, but it's also not all the way back. It's in more of like a neutral position. And I think the way that I get away with doing that is when I lift up my shoulder, it creates a place for that stock to be on my shoulder, and it's flat on my shoulder, basically like exactly like you described. And when I lift it up to my face, it does that and also puts the stock into my cheek. But I find when I do that, it doesn't require a whole lot of energy on my part, almost none. And I actually started showing people this in class. If I do that, just blade just a little bit with my upper half, like I can hold the gun with two fingers on the rail, two fingers at the back half of the gun, and rip doubles at, I don't know, 25, 30 yards and hold a softball size group. And it's because I think it's really, really easy to hold the gun like that. And I find it really easy to hold it like that. Therefore, I'm not putting different inputs into the gun. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, you see a lot of people shoot. I see a lot of people shoot. I think where people go wrong, because they'll pick a technique, they'll pick yours, they'll pick mine, whatever, but they start like wrestling with the gun. We'll say like, oh, Joe said pull with this hand, or Nick said pull with this hand, and they give it like 1,000%. And it's like that 1,000% may only be 1,000% for like two rounds. And then after that, they just spend the rest of the time like trying to steer the gun back down. And so like that's the place where I think people kind of go wrong. But I would encourage people, dude, try everyone's technique and see if it, you know, try it all. Freaking see if it works for you and your specific gear.
At the end of the day, that's what you have to do. Take all the techniques, try them out. I will take any technique that somebody throws at me and I'll put it to the test of, is it faster? Is it more accurate? Is it consistent? Those are the three things I ask, right? Even like, I don't know, it was 2 years ago or last year, maybe you and I had different techniques for entering a position. And I sat there and ran it 20 times my way, 20 times your way, 20 times my way, 20 times your way, averaged everything out.
Same here.
It was so close. Yep. It's very, very close to the same time. So when there's no difference between them, and this is really important too, because it ends a lot of arguments, because if there's a performance difference that one's better than the other, then you're an idiot if you don't follow it. Okay. However, if there's no performance difference on those three standards, accuracy, speed, and consistency, then it's personal preference and your feelings matter again. And so if you feel like this one's better for you, that it's more comfortable for you, guess what?
It's all yours.
Feelings matter. Go do it. If there is a performance difference, your feelings don't matter. That's where that's what it comes down to. But you're not going to know that until you try it. So try the different grips, try the different mounts, see what works well, put it on the timer. And then don't just stick with that because that's what you decided to do 5 years ago. You learned this in a class with, you know, Christian or Nick or whoever, right? You stick with it because you've tested other things and it's still coming back to this is currently the best mode. All right. I've evolved the way that I teach and the way that I shoot 1,000 times over the past 10 years.
Oh, 100%.
The things I was teaching 2 years ago are different than what I'm teaching today. That doesn't mean that the principles have changed. It's that I've evolved and I've learned new ways to teach things. I've changed the way that I've built my structure because I'm constantly testing and practicing new things. All right. The whole like right foot forward thing that came because I was working on an awkward start position with a rifle. You know, I practice right foot forward draws. That's really wild. If you've never done that, people are like, holy shit, I don't know how to draw my pistol all of a sudden. Like, yeah, it's because you only draw it one way. Okay. Yeah. Put your right foot forward, see what happens. Well, guess what? Some stages and matches, you're going to have to do that. All right. Same thing with a rifle. If you have a stage where you've got a really wide transition, you know, right to left or left to right, you're gonna have to pick which one you start on. Well, I will tell you, I can quantifiably show this, doing a hard, especially a farther transition right to left is faster than left to right because your head can come off the stock and the gun will snap to your eyes. I've done it 100 times or thousands of times and shown that. So when we start right foot forward, it's a very awkward feeling, but what I found practicing that was, hey, my recoil is like really different than what I'm used to because my right foot's forward instead of my left foot. I'm bladed the opposite way that most people would blade. And suddenly I'm learning some things. Then when I bring that out in a class format, especially the dudes who have shot a whole lot, there's some light bulbs that go on. Now, I'm not saying this the way you should shoot all the time, but it's something to play with. Yeah. So screw with it.
I like that a lot. How would you describe, or if someone asked you, hey man, does rifle index matter? Just like you would index a pistol on a target. Does it matter? And how would you go about getting better at that? Is there a specific drill? Is there dry fire? Like what would you do with that?
I don't spend a ton of time on rifle index.
I did not expect you to say that.
If I'm sitting there squared up to a target, the rifle's going to come up. It's going to come up generally in the area. You're going to make a small correction to what you need and then put it on target. The thing is rifle index matters a lot for a static range, but nothing that I do is static, or very little that I do is static. As soon as you add movement in, your shoulders, the way that we square up to the target is going to, you know, dictate the index. So being consistent with the way we mount the rifle is gonna help you with your consistency and index. I found is if I have one target that I'm shooting, then yeah, I'll bring that rifle up, I'll drop it down or, you know, low ready or whatever, and then it's index. Like I don't spend a whole lot of time on that.
So I think we're talking about the same. So Like, when I mean index, if I look to a target, the gun shows up exactly where I'm looking on the target. That's what I mean. So, like, transitions, movement, all of that stuff. Like, I want to look to a spot, and the gun just shows up on that spot. That's what I mean by, like, developing a good index.
Okay, so then that's different from what I was talking about. I was talking about more like a body, body-directed index, a physical index. I mean, you being able to look to a spot and drive the gun to that spot and have it where it needs to be is a crucial part of your rifle structure. And I think that if you don't have that, if you're not able to bring the gun to where you're looking at, then we've got a problem. That's part of a failed structure there. And again, going back to what we were talking about earlier with super high mounts, I've seen that as a big problem when we run a 193 or higher mount 100%. Is we're not getting consistent index because the cheek weld's not consistent.
Yes. And dude, this is when, like, I'm sure you get asked this question too. People will be like, hey man, I overconfirm. How do I stop doing it? And my gut reaction to pretty much every time is like, you need to build a better index. You need to build a better index, and then you need to start looking for specific things on the sight, whether it's you're looking for the color of the sight, whether it's you're looking for a streak, whatever the case may be in terms of confirmation. But like, the index has to be there. That way you can actually look to a spot, the gun shows up, and then you could shoot immediately.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, sweet. All right, last little bit, and I think this will probably take up the majority of the time. So there's a ton of conversation currently online talking about instructors shooting matches.